Our next speaker is Dr. David Crowley. David is an environmental microbiologist at the University of California in Riverside. His research program focuses on bioremediation of organic pollutants, as well as the linkage of microbial community structure and function using biochemical and molecular biology methods. Today, he's going to tell you a little bit more of his current research.
All right. Thanks, Rob. Well, good morning. It's a real pleasure to be here this morning and take part in this symposium. As the first two speakers have pointed out, one of the main challenges today in working with microbial communities is trying to figure out the appropriate methods to link environmental factors to the development of a particular microbial community structure, and then how that structure relates back to function. We've been dealing with this question in my lab for at least the last 20 years, beginning with denaturing gradient gels and then on to Biolog and then to PLFA methods and more recently to the high throughput methods. And one of the most useful techniques that we've found in the last few years for linking these profiles to community structures or to environmental variables has been the use of artificial neural networks. So what I'd like to do today is give you a brief overview of how we can apply these new software programs that are available for community analysis. Now, there are several fundamental questions. First is, we assume that there's going to be a distinct linkage between a particular taxonomic composition of a community and then how that will relate to an ecosystem level process. This is still a hypothesis, and that's because there are so many bacteria that carry out the same functions and they can belong to distinct taxonomic groups that so far it's very difficult to assign a particular profile to a particular function. And then we take it a step further when we look at a specific DNA signature, the 16S gene in this case, or other types of genes that we might be interested in for monitoring, and then develop a profile based on those and then try and link it back to the effects of specific environmental variables. Now, this slide highlights some of the problems that we're dealing with in terms of the resolution of microbial communities. And if we look at the big picture, we can clearly see the structure of the community and we can think about the overall ecosystem. But most of our techniques we use today for environmental quality monitoring deal with things like biomass, a few enzymes, respiration, these sorts of broad-scale activities. On the other end, we have the metagenomics, and here we can look at specific gene libraries, and we need thousands of data points even to begin to see some sort of structure to emerge from the community. And then in between, we have the lower resolution methods of denaturing gradient gels and fatty acids, where we see specific things that we're looking for, but we still don't have a good clue about what is comprised there at the genetic level or taxonomically. So this highlights the problem and some of the different techniques that have been used. We're all using different methods, ranging from enzyme activities, which were very important through the 70s and 80s, today still, phospholipid fatty acid analysis, again going up through the molecular biology techniques. And as we look to the future, we're seeing more data coming in with microarrays and with metagenomic approaches. So these pose real challenges for us. And we're all looking at the elephant here trying to decide what's the best method to use. Now, this is the current state then. Our techniques that we use today, denaturing gradient gels and PLFA, are very low resolution. You're looking at some 30 to 50 bands in a denaturing gradient gel, or maybe that same number of fatty acids, which are representing communities that are comprised of tens of thousands of species belonging to different taxonomic groups. So these are very, very low resolution methods. And the data analysis techniques are also really difficult, both to apply and to explain to other people. Principal components is one of the main methods that's used today. This is a very powerful technique, but it's hard to generate a story about what your data really means when you're looking at 39% variation on principal component one. This sort of thing. So there have been some limitations with the statistical methods that we have. For example, if we look at the distribution of alpha proteobacteria in relation to water-soluble organic carbon, this is from a data set that I'll be showing you with the neural network data later, This is the sort of relationship that you can see. There's a scatter plot, and there's no way to determine if these are going up or down. And this is because we have so many variables acting simultaneously on the community. We also have differences in pH. We have clay content, salinity, so many different variables operating at the same time that are causing these shifts in the population size of these groups. Well, to solve this problem, I looked into the use of artificial neural networks, which are now widely used in almost every other endeavor of science, including, going beyond science, market analysis, which is still, I think, a very soft science, but handwriting, voice recognition, defense uses artificial neural networks to recognize an enemy plane versus a friendly plane. Medical, it's used widely for EKGs, EEGs, anything where you're looking for pattern recognition. And in the environmental field, we're just starting to see this to be used for analysis of environmental data. Now, the idea behind this is, with a neural network, is that you're training a computer to operate like your brain. And you have a set of neurons, and in this case, the neurons receive a signal from somewhere else, and then they transmit it here to this axon, and then if this receives a sufficiently large signal, then it fires, and then it sends its signal to the next one. So the computer is done the same way. The hierarchy is set up here with an input layer, and then it's mathematically weighted to generate a signal here, which then will either be a yes or no, and then send the signal again to yet another layer, the output layer. So the architecture is simulated in the computer software. This is basically what it looks like. You have an input layer, a hidden layer, and then an output. And your input, these are the direct variables that you're interested in. It could be the community structure, environmental variables, soil pH, very different disparate types of variables. And then it goes to a question that you want to answer, disease status or plant yields. And here, each of these begin as just an unweighted line, and then you have a training set, data set, which is used to go through this program. It cycles through, and if it measures the error here at the end, and if it's a large error, then it comes back and it changes these weights differently. And finally, at the end, after about 500 to several thousand training cycles, it's now built up mathematical relationships between each of these different neurons that allows it to recognize patterns. And that's the same thing that we do when a new baby is born. It recognizes its mother, more training, it recognizes new people, its father, and so on. And then we're constantly training and recognizing patterns in nature. Now, one of the things that you have to be careful with when you're working with a neural network is that you don't overtrain the model. You're just looking at it being trained enough so that it can recognize the general patterns for both the training data and also for a test data set that it's never seen before. So when it's appropriately trained, it will generate a curve or whatever function best fits the both the training and test data. And if you overtrain it, then it becomes very locked in to only the training data set, but no longer recognizes the test data. This is very different than a regular statistical procedure because we're always looking at exact numbers on means and standard deviations. But in a neural net model, you might actually construct 10, 15 models before you find the one that has the very best fit. And you also have to go through and give it optimization on the number of training cycles that you use. So basically, you train it through a number of cycles. The error becomes less and less for the training data set. And then at some point, when it's overtrained, then you see the error increasing for the test data. So the network is optimized at this point when you've trained it just enough to fit both the test and the training data together with minimal error. Now, the program I've been using for this work is called Pelterian Synapse. This is one of the most accessible, a little bit expensive, $1,200, but you can download it free for a month, and it's got great tutorials. And if you're interested in working with a really good quality program, this is one I would recommend. Now, as an example of how you can apply this, we started out with one type of neural network called a Cajon and self-organizing map. And this was a paper we published in Ag Ecosystems and Environment in 2007. And here we were looking at different land areas and different land uses. We had 20 wheat fields, two regions, four soil classes, and we had preserved and remnant areas versus the field soils. And our microbiological analysis included TRFLP, and we had PLFA, glomalin, and the soil analyses. Now, taking a look at how this works in a Cahonin self-organizing map, the output actually gives you a correlation of everything that goes into this all at once. And so it's not a spatial map, but it's a map of the relationships between all the different variables. And this is what it looks like for that particular study. In this case, you can see the different soil geomorphic classes distinguished by the two colors, white and black. And then here you see high pH, down here is low pH. Where we have high pH, we have low glomalin. We also see here, for example, low ammonia goes with this particular soil geomorphic class. And you can go through and look at each of these different variables to see how they correspond. For example, here's a principal component for the TRFLP, and you can see that it corresponds very directly with pH, which tells us then what we already expect, that pH is one of the major drivers for determining the microbial community structure. Now, I've got some other examples as well. I was going to originally show you one about Brazil with PLFA, but recently we conducted a study that has much more, higher throughput sequences, which gives us a lot more data to work with. And here we compared 34 fallow soils, conventional versus organic. And we had 58,016 S sequences that were generated by Illumina. And in addition to that, we looked at survival of E. coli. And we bring in all the different soil analysis, NPK, how it was managed, the pH, salinity, texture, and so on. Now, this shows the Cahonin self-organizing map that's generated from that. And here again, you see the managed versus the organic distinguished separately. This shows the electrical conductivity. So we see low electrical conductivity, 0.2, going up to 3.4 at the high end. So low EC corresponds to low pH, low water holding capacity, and high sand. So it's telling us what we would expect already from the data. Now, we can also see things that are very obvious, like high sand, low clay, high bulk density with the high sand. And then getting into the other characters here, for example, microbial biomass carbon. We see that it's low in this corner, and then there's a high patch over here. Now, we can look through and see where that corresponds. Primarily corresponds to high clay content. Looking at the specific groups now, we can see the different taxonomic groups as the OTUs were sorted into. And here you see, for example, that high pH is associated with the actinomycetes. And we can also go down here to the proteobacteria. This is an interesting one. Here you see the alpha proteobacteria are low, the beta proteobacteria are high, and the delta are low. So that tells us that within this group, those three are competing with each other and displacing each other. The gamma proteobacteria, on the other hand, seem to be off on their own independent. And the basic thing that you get out of this is that you can examine all of your variables simultaneously on one page, just using this visual correlation inspection. Now, it may not be cause and effect, but you can establish hypotheses that you can go back to and then reexamine. Now, in the when you go a little further with a model, you get a sensitivity analysis, and this tells us the weight of various variables in terms of influencing the network connections. And here you see clay, aluminum, organic matter, and pH were the main variables. So we might go through and reconstruct another model where we eliminate things that are not important. But at the end, you also end up with a tool where you have a set of slide bars. And here we can adjust each of these different slide bars to whatever condition we want and then predict a particular output, for example, a fungal bacterial ratio. And this then allows us to generate plots on each of these different factors independently. So in this study, we will be sliding these things back and forth and then looking at things like biomass, proteobacteria, and E. coli survival. The plot that's generated from this shows for pH effects on microbial biomass carbon, no effect. But clay content, you see it going up by a factor of almost 4. So this is something that we would expect, something that's reassuring when you see that in the output. Organic carbon, this was interesting. Total organic carbon has very little effect on the microbial biomass, but water-soluble organic carbon proves to be the most important in determining biomass. Also the total nitrogen. If we look at the construction of the community in terms with each of these different variables, here you see the effects of pH. And for example, here you see the proteobacteria at pH 6.8 only comprise about 10% of the community. But as we go up in pH, then at pH 8, it's comprising about 60% of the bacterial community. And we can look at the same things happening here. Clay content not really affecting the overall community structure. Here with EC, you'd get more of a curvilinear effect. Here you see the proteobacteria, which contain many of the plant growth promoting bacteria, are important at low EC. Intermediate EC, 0.5, they're fine. At 1, they begin to diminish, and at 2, they're minimal. And then you see it going back up again, and its other groups begin to be displaced at higher EC values. So it's an extremely powerful tool in terms of setting individual variables and looking at how they affect the community structure. Looking at the classes of proteobacteria, this shows the distribution in terms of water-soluble organic carbon. And again, we're concerned primarily with the alpha proteobacteria, which contain many of the plant growth promoting bacteria. And here we see that increasing water-soluble organic carbon leads to 90% abundance of the alpha proteobacteria. And this suggests that something like a compost tea, for example, with high soluble carbon might be promoting these types of bacteria. And the same thing, you see the effects here on salinity. This is the last one on the Kohonen maps, but this is for E. coli included in the system. And we were looking at the time to disappearance for E. coli, a pathogenic strain that was, we took soil samples back to the lab and introduced E. coli into the soils. And here you see the high survival, up to 33 days, 34 days, and it's primarily associated with managed organic farm. And it tends to be associated with a higher pH and also with high levels of water-soluble organic carbon. So again, we inspect the different variables visually, and then we go back and we look at them independently with the model. And here you see the difference. This is organic farming managed. This is conventionally managed. And you see that the effects of salinity are very important here in controlling the survival of E. coli in this system. As EC goes to 3, the E. coli will only survive for about a week. However, in an organically managed system under high salinity, it's predicted to last for some 40 days. You see also the effects here of total nitrogen and of clay content. So what we have then is a decision support tool. A farmer could go to this particular tool, the site, if it was established on the internet, look at their particular soil conditions, adjusting those slide bars, and then make a prediction that this is a high-risk situation. So it's an extremely powerful tool for this type of application. Many different advantages of neural networks. I don't have time to review all these, but if you look into the literature, you'll find that they have all kinds of advantages. They will not replace conventional statistics, but they're a great additional tool that I highly recommend for examining your data. It really makes sense out of things that initially look very puzzling. Now, in the future, we're looking at applying microarray data into these systems, and there are now microarrays being developed to look at all these different types of functions, including community structure, nutrient cycling, plant growth promotion, biodegradation, and eventually we hope to bring these into the neural network analysis where we tie these back to the community function. And then finally, what we're looking at is, in the long range, developing computational models. If you add a particular organism, you look at it through the microarray, how that affects the entire gene expression in the system. And then this should be fed into the neural networks to give you specific information on the effects of an environmental variable on that community and its function. So it's an exciting new tool, and I hope you'll take advantage of it. If you've got any questions as we go after this is over, feel free to contact me. But in terms of summarizing for today, I think based on my experience so far, I found it to be a very powerful approach. I think it's providing brand new insight into community structure that we haven't been able to get before. And we need to do further research on developing these decision support tools, especially providing them to farmers and policymakers who could use these types of tools to experiment and manipulate the data to see what the outcomes are. So with that, I will close. Thank you.